Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. All right, so it is a fifth week, which means it's a lighter comics week, it's a lighter news week, but we still got a podcast here for you.
I like fifth weeks because they're loco.
Yeah.
Loco?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's when there's like the slightly offbeat stuff is all out.
That's true. There's some weird
stuff
this
week. Like I'm saying, in a world where the app game or Steam game, whatever World of Tanks is, comes out written by Garth Ennis, it's a loco week.
That's pretty weird. I don't know if that was just a week. That's just weird. That's just Dark Horse being weird.
Yeah.
I think that's just Garth Ennis loving tanks.
That's actually true, too. All right. So this week we've got Thursday, September 1st is going to be our D&D encounter, our D&D Adventurers League, as usual. But if you've not been playing and you've been kind of wanting to drop in, they are starting the Storm King's Thunder adventure this week.
Yeah, yep. One of our DMs, Jose, was telling me about it and how the initial adventure leads into it and how there's going to get some higher levels going on in there. And I know some of the twists and turns, and it sounds cool to me.
Oh.
It is, of course, it's giants and stuff.
Sure.
But not just giants. There's all sorts of other plots that interweave. And some cool opportunities I already know in advance for players to make some interesting choices.
Okay.
So that they have kind of an interesting sandbox quality to some of the parts.
And yeah, so that's a good chance to drop in on our D&D Adventures League. Once you can always drop in.
Yep.
But this is
literally the start of the adventure.
Particularly good jumping on point if you've been wanting to play D&D.
And if you go by our store's Facebook page, I just posted a link to the player's guide. So if you want to make a character and join it, you know, have it ready to roll on this first night, which is encouraged, they have all the parameters there. They'll tell you what books you can and can't use and all that stuff.
Cool. This Monday coming up is our Labor Day sale.
Oh, right.
Yeah, we will be 15% off on most everything in the store. I think single issues are exempted, but for the most part, the store will be on sale 15% off. If you have a rogue card, it's an additional 5% off.
Nice.
So, yeah, make sure and stop in on Monday and pick up that stuff that's been you've been keeping your eye on. Then on Saturday, September 10th, we'll be doing our X-Wing Miniatures game again. We had a few people turn out. We would love to have more people come out for that, but they brought a bunch of ships, so if you have not played before, if you don't own any ships, I feel like there'll probably be plenty of stuff to play with.
Yep, you can just kind of jump in, they'll get you dog fighting.
And then Saturday, September 17th is our Gaming with Rogues this month. It is going to be Smash Up, the card game where you are a mix of either, you know, alien wizards, ninja time travelers,
yep,
any number of factions that combine, and then you try to take various bases. A lot of fun, one of our favorites, and we actually did this very early on in the Gaming with Rogues lifespan, but it was a while back.
Time for revisit?
Yes. Saturday, September 17th, that night is, well, that day, I guess, is Batman Day.
Right.
So that's going to be all day. The first 200 people will get free Batman number ones. And hopefully that means everybody will get it. We don't know how many people will come out, but we're hoping to have enough for everyone. Batman and Catwoman will be here. You can take pictures with them, and that's kind of cool.
Yep.
And then we will have a 15% off sale on all things Batman that day.
We need to make sure she's not stealing anything.
That's true. It's a good point. Well, she's really in character.
You know what? If she did that thing where she goes up with a clawed hands and like does the perfect circle cut into our display case,
magic case,
I'd let her take something.
Sure,
because that's cool.
Yeah,
I always liked when she did that.
I feel like Catwoman is more a like jewel thief than a say Magic the Gathering kind of thing.
No, but she like take one of our statues or something like that. She's like, oh, that's a bombshell of me. I'm taking it.
Yeah, reasonable point. Sunday, September 25th is Magic the Gathering Kaladesh pre-release. And then just looking ahead in October, we're going to have Reading with Rogues, but that means that starting this Thursday, September 1st, the book of the month for September is Batman Long Halloween as a as both a celebration of Batman Day and Batman Month,
yep,
and also a nod to the coming of Halloween, which I believe most of my friends have been anticipating for like the last 6 months.
Yes.
Because most of my friends treat Halloween like Christmas.
Yep, and I have decided to get an early start on it, and I've dubbing September, September.
Oh, I see. but if you buy Batman Long Halloween during September, you'll get a 15% off. If you have a rogue card, it's 25% off. All right, that's our store news. Let's get to the news this week. And again, a lighter news week, but there's some interesting stuff. One of the big things is that we got a movie lineup announced for The New Mutants.
Right. And it's pretty much what I hoped and prayed it would be.
Yep. Native American Daniel Moonstar, Scots Girl Wolfsbane, Brazilian Ladies Man Sunspot, a Kentuckian codenamed Cannonball, and Russian Teen Magic. Also in the mix will be an alien named Warlock.
Yeah, the only person they left out of the initial New Mutants lineup is, Shan.
Karma.
Karma.
Magma didn't join till later.
And Magma didn't join till later. I actually think that's a decent swap because Danny Moonstar, or as she was known in those very early issues, Psyche, I believe.
Was she Psyche? That's right. She was Mirage.
Not a great
name. But she was Psyche first.
Yeah. Mirage is a better name. Psyche kind of sucks.
It could be Psyche, because it was the 80s.
But she's one of those that graduated to just being known by her actual name because she's Native American and Moonstar sounds cool.
Yeah.
And it does, to be fair.
Dave, is it possible? We're supposed to be Psyche, like faking you out? Because she would call up your greatest fear. It's like Psyche.
Amazing, but that assumes that Chris Claremont was not really still into 70s slang in the 80s.
Yeah.
But she has mind powers and Karma does too, and it's like that mind possession stuff, which often tends to be like a villain power,
right?
You know, because it's kind of creepy.
Yep.
So I can understand them making the cut on her, and Magma has more blasty powers. Which does anybody else? No, none of the
Magma's not in it.
Oh, I thought you said she was going
to. No, I said she's not in it.
Oh, okay. She would make sense to have in there, but that's also a slightly dangerous one because, like the Human Torch, she burns things.
Yeah.
And it's hard for that not to be a villain power. I don't know how they deal with it in the FF all the time.
He's just constantly leaving villains with third-degree burns.
Oh, God! but anyway, that's my team.
Yeah.
You know, the big ones, like getting Sunspot and Cannonball in there.
Yep.
Rain, Danny Moonstar is awesome. I was worried they were going to do all, like, the X-Men Academy type stuff.
Crazy Grant Morrison inventions.
Crazy Grant Morrison floating brains and all that, and the Stepford Cuckoos. And I sometimes like those characters, but they ain't the New Mutants.
No, this is perfect. It's the writers of, I think, Fault in Our Stars, with the director of Fault in Our Stars.
So they're going to...
Which, I wasn't crazy about Fault in Our Stars, the movie. No. But but I think that that's probably the right people to be on it.
Yeah.
Just saying, where's Doug Ramsey? Where's he?
Doug Ramsey doesn't come until later.
No, but Cypher's cool.
Cypher's cool, but that's the thing. You introduce Warlock now, you bring in Cypher, you bring in Magma on the second movie.
I guess I will just be happy to hear Self Friend.
Yeah.
who do you get to voice Warlock, though?
You get...
Johnny Five.
you get Vin Diesel. Because Vin Diesel does all the voices.
Well, whoever it is, their voice has got to go through like an electronic filter anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
So it's going to get buried under there. I do feel like a, you know, a cool CG Warlock could look really cool.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of constantly changing, but bioorganic and all that stuff. Bill Sienkiewicz's classic designs, I think, could actually look really good if they did that black and gold sort of effect that Warlock had.
It'll be interesting to see how they approach all the different powers and effects, because Sunspot in particular can look look awesome at times, but... Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how they do his sort of charging up. And
well, wait a minute. Sunspot was in Days of Future Past. It was the grown-up Sunspot. Remember, he could fly and all that, but they did have Sunspot in there.
Really?
Yeah.
Forgot about
when
that.
When did Sunspot fly?
He flies now. I mean, that was a thing. He was during the X-Force days, I believe, he powered up.
They don't do that.
No, it was. I mean, they've already done it.
Yeah.
That was sort of his powered-up, grown-up version.
Do you think that they will be... Well, yeah, I guess it doesn't really matter particularly what his grown-up version was like. They're going to...
Yeah.
The X-Men movies continuity is always kind of loose with each other.
Yeah.
You say loose, I say broken.
Honestly, some friends of mine posted on Facebook, they'll be like, it'll be fine as long as Singer stays away from it.
Yeah.
And I've fallen into that camp. I'm ready for him to never touch X-Men again.
Well, and yet, X-Men and X-Men 2 are some of your favorite superhero movies. In fact, higher than the Marvel Cinematic for you.
Sometimes, yeah. I haven't revisited them in a while, so I'd be curious to see
how was X-Men Apocalypse?
X-Men Apocalypse was a giant load of shit. Kids cover your ears. Man, you know what? I've told that to people before, and a few of them have seen it, and they're like, "Oh, it's okay." You know, sort of the closer to like my reaction to Suicide Squad or something like that. So I don't know. Did y'all watch it?
No,
it's actually the first X-Men movie I have not seen.
Curious to hear what you think, but I was like kind of like bored.
Yeah,
and like the previous ones, like the First Class stuff, I was like, well, those were kind of energetic. I liked the characters in them,
yeah,
and all that. And this one, I was just, It felt like it was going through the motions and didn't know what to do.
Could it be that we heard Apocalypse scream, everything he builds or will, they build, will fall like a billion times?
Too often on our store's YouTube page.
It's possible. All I know, my new rule is I'm not going to see superhero movies that I think are going to suck. So I have not seen Batman vs. Superman, Suicide Squad, or X-Men Apocalypse. And I feel like pretty much okay with that.
Missed out on some fun, Randy.
I'm sure I did. What I did see was Civil War, and I love that. And that's coming to Blu-ray this week? Next week.
Oh, is it next week?
It's next week.
Okay.
Or maybe 2 weeks. I don't know.
It's
soon.
It's probably already out digitally right now.
It probably is. Because they showed a special feature that's on the Blu-ray, which is Civil War Team Thor. It is directed by Taika Waititi, which I'm sure is not how you pronounce his name.
It's close.
He's the guy who directed What We Do in the Shadows, which we all loved. And he's going to direct Thor Ragnarok, which is in production. And this is basically a goofy Australian Flight of the Conchords type thing. I know Flight of the Conchords from New Zealand, but this was set in Australia, where Thor, during Civil War, is basically living in Australia with his roommate, Daryl.
Yep.
And sending emails with the help of Daryl at work, hanging out with Bruce Banner, wondering why Thor and Captain America and Iron Man haven't called. It was a really fun little short, I thought.
And I want this to be the approach for Thor Ragnarok.
I don't actually want it to be in the Marvel Universe. I like it as a gag.
Yeah,
I don't want that to appear in the actual Marvel Universe. But it was a lot of fun, and it's
the Deadpool route.
Yes. It was fun to see Chris Hemsworth get to sort of goof around
up a bit. Yeah.
That feels less like Deadpool and more like sort of the Mike Allred's Ecstatics or something like
maybe
that.
So. Marvel's got their PR down. I always wonder kind of how much is just sort of that general sense of teamwork and hiring good people for their mm-hmm. movies. And and how much is like their PR people saying, "Hey, do this."
Yeah.
Like Brie Larson reading Captain Marvel comics in her like Captain Marvel PJs or whatever. Yeah. Great, Instagram photo, super cool, you know, suggestion of it instantly suggests that the actress is both interested in the source material, supports it. She's kind of on the geeky
side.
Sir,
are you saying all of these things are staged?
I'm saying maybe, but I'm saying if so, they're staging things much better than, say, DC. Like, more recently, I heard that, like, Ben Affleck tweeted something that, like, hinted at Deathstroke in the new...
Well,
next movie.
That's actually our next news. Yeah. That Deathstroke. I thought it was confirmed. Is it just?
No, I think it is confirmed.
It's confirmed.
All I know is that it seemed like it was people were like, it's kind of an awkward clue, or it was weird, or something about it.
Well, it seems
like it didn't seem like people were like. I mean, Deathstroke. That's pretty big, but
you know the funny thing is though, Ben Affleck is a guy who I know Ben Affleck is excited about all this. Like Affleck's always been sort of nerdy.
Yeah,
he's got that.
Comics.
Yeah, he likes comics.
He doesn't love them as much as Nick Cage loves them.
No one loves comics as much as Nick Cage loves them. In a way that only Nick Cage could.
I could play Darkseid.
But yeah,
it
turns out that in the standalone Batman movie that Affleck is writing and directing,
yep.
right?
Yeah.
Writing, directing, starring in, presumably doing the catering.
Yeah.
Deathstroke is going to be the villain, which is weird to me. But at the same time, I'm like, that's kind of cool. I kind of like it.
It is cool.
It makes sense to me.
I mean, Deathstroke is always Green Arrow villain to me. I don't know.
Oh, really?
Deathstroke's a Teen Titans villain.
I don't know how he got it in my head as a Green Arrow villain.
Well, I mean, that was something that
way back in
Brad Meltzer's run, yeah.
Identity Crisis.
Yeah.
Green Arrow.
But I know Judd Winnick has written the sort of rivalry between the two when he was writing Green Arrow.
And yeah, it kind of became a thing for a few years, and that just happened to be probably not too long after you were kind of getting back into comics.
I agree.
You
just plugged into it.
I agree that he's a Titans villain, too. I mean, that's where he was mostly but...
I like the rivalry. He was more recently, and of course, Arrow on the TV show is basically Batman-esque.
Yeah. Right.
And he was pretty heavily featured in like one or two of the last Arkham games, if I'm not mistaken. Like,
yeah.
Not maybe main villain, but up there.
Well, yeah.
His boss battle fight was the thing that made me throw the controller and not play it ever again.
Yep.
Because that game infuriated me.
It is weird to me, though, that basically in the new sort of Batman universe, we've had the Joker. But nobody else, like no Catwoman, right? Oh, we had Catwoman Batman Rises, but Dark Knight Rises almost seems like a different Batman. Like it's not in continuity with the current Batman, is it?
No, I don't think so.
No, you're talking about the Nolan stuff?
Yeah.
No, it's
that's its own thing.
They're definitely off to their own world, and What do we have? Joker only?
Joker only. As Joker and Harley Quinn.
Harley, Joker, and sure, you can write it.
And Killer Croc.
I guess you can say Killer Croc and Deadshot, they acknowledged a lot of that in the movie.
Yeah. But, like, I it's weird to me that to go with Batman and go, well, let's do that. I mean, it speaks to, like, what are the fans...
Oh, that makes sense to
what
me.
What are the fans going to think is cool? And yeah. I'm like, that's probably a step in the right direction for DC. Now, it's not what the old school fans think is cool. It's the 90s New 52 guys. Yep. But that's probably their audience.
You know what? I like Deathstroke.
I do, too.
One of the reasons, though, to me, it's kind of like the obvious pairing. He's sort of like a heightened Batman. That yeah. With a little bit of powers.
Yeah.
But he's really, I see, he is a mercenary. I don't think of him as a big boss. And
yeah.
So I feel like somebody needs to be pulling his strings, and maybe that person could be more interesting character. But yeah, like, Deathstroke versus Batman alone, to me, is a boring concept.
Yeah, I hope there's more to it.
I do suspect that Affleck will find something to plug into there.
Yeah.
He's going to be, I think he's a fan on the level of sort of like the way Nolan is.
Yeah.
In a different way, but similar in the sense that he kind of sees the potential for what he would probably think of as like more adult storylines with them. And I don't think, I don't know where I was going with that. I just don't think he's not a fan in the way that the fans of the Flash TV show or the writers on the Flash TV show are fans of superheroes.
Right, I agree, and
he
I think
wants
that's
to
kinda...
see the sort of use of some more sophisticated stories.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the DC's shared cinematic universe is never going to be what I want it to be, which is basically a carbon copy of what Marvel did, but for DC.
Right. If they could basically make it similar to, but more expensive than the TV shows that they're doing,
yeah,
that would be a lot closer.
That'd be closer.
But
still darker than I like.
What, the TV shows?
Yeah.
Maybe Arrow, but like Flash is...
Flash got pretty dark in season 2. Flash, you didn't finish it.
Yeah, it's true. I got bored.
Uh-huh.
But apparently, they announced in season 3 they're back to doing lighter stuff.
That's not what the trailer looked like.
The same way that Arrow was back to doing...
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff. I mean... I'm only repeating what I saw.
I don't believe them.
Do you think
I don't
they just say
them.
That? Yes. Just like it's going to be lighter fans.
Yes.
I know that's what you like to hear. That's the buzzword.
Yep. I don't believe them until I see it. I'm just wondering
if that's the trend. Then Supergirl is going to get darker.
I'm also worried about that.
Really don't want that.
Me neither.
Really, really don't want it.
But that doesn't mean it's not going to happen.
Right.
I'm worried about the future of DC TV because this last season really disappointed me in a lot of ways. Even though there was stuff I liked a lot. And I love Supergirl, and I want Supergirl to be good.
This season of Arrow killed my interest in that show completely.
Probably me too. I don't know.
I'm going to rewind for just a second back to the New Mutants thing.
Yeah.
Quick question. Is the Bill Sienkiewicz Claremont stuff in print in any form right now?
I don't know, actually. They were doing those classic New Mutants trades, but I don't know if they are, actually.
I'm not sure if that's out or that they were doing Epic Collections. We should look into that because as we get closer to the movie, I know people are going to want to look at it. And
it's really good stuff.
Who was the leader of that team? Moonstar.
Moonstar, yeah, right. And Cannonball. The two of them traded off.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, they were both leads.
You know, for people who didn't see that, you know, the same way that the X-Men of the 70s, the relaunch with X, you know, was very multinational.
Yeah.
You know, Nightcrawler from Germany, Wolverine from Canada, Storm from Africa. The New Mutants was also highly international. They were Brazilian, Scottish.
But more to the point, it was also different parts of America. You know, Cannonball's from Kentucky.
Right. And he was
Moonstar was from Colorado. They were not
right.
They were not like all New York heroes.
Correct. And, you know, Cannonball was, just as a random example, was an interesting character. He was almost like a... would have been like a sort of a nerdy, geeky guy anywhere else, but he had to grow up and work in a coal mine.
Yeah.
But, I always remember that he was like a science fiction geek and stuff like that. His bromance with Sunspot should be like very much at the heart of the movie, hopefully.
I think that people are going to discover, in the same way that Rocket and Groot became a thing,
uh-huh,
if they do it right, there should be slash fiction of Cannonball and Sunspot up within the days.
Right. Out of the gate.
I'm sure it exists now. What are you
right, but this will be the movie.
This will be much bigger. People will actually know about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to see, I mean, you know, that was when Bill Sienkiewicz came on as artist, it kind of changed it. You know,
yeah.
The same way that, like, when Frank Miller came on to Daredevil,
mm-hmm,
yeah, that was the same character that had been written the year before, like, the years prior, but things were different.
Yeah.
Way different. And in this case, it was still the same writer. Claremont had been doing, like, the first dozen issues. But Sienkiewicz's artwork gave it this kind of edginess to it that Wasn't
Sing Adventures like first issue the Demon Bear stuff? Or was
Yeah. Which is probably their best storyline that they
That's got to be the sequel. You got to do the sequel.
I think so. It was like super scary, and you know, you can tie in some other stuff, but
I'm curious who the villain's going to be in the New Mutants movie.
Yeah,
they have really, a rogues gallery, but it's like nobody.
Their early villains were Sentinels and creepy brood stuff that was spillover from X-Men.
Yeah.
Axe, of course.
You know, actually, the brood would not be the weirdest thing if you're doing a warlock thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But they can also do magus if they really like want to do a scary world-ending kind of threat they have to defeat.
I kind of like the idea of the brood because it gives them a slightly scary intro thing. I'd like to see some serious Sentinels, too, because the movies have still never done Sentinels to my satisfaction.
Yeah.
What if they do warlocks, or the phalanx?
The Phalanx, I hope not. The Phalanx is such a 90s, like, later thing.
Yeah.
I don't hate it. I almost hate it. But I don't want it to be the first thing they do.
I do think a good bad guy would be kind of nice.
Yeah.
You know, the Hellfire Club were trying to recruit them originally.
That's right.
The only way I would want them to do that is if they kind of disavowed all the other X-Men movies and just kind of rebuild from the ground up.
Which they're not going to do.
Well, yeah. Because Sunspot's father was part of the Hellfire Club, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they want the cachet. They want a shared universe really badly. So they want the X-Men to be a shared universe.
You know, the guy who was in charge of, who was trying to recruit them originally was...
Donald Pierce,
who had been one of the Hellfire Club guards when Wolverine, famously, when they infiltrated that, tore the crap out of all those guards and cyborged them up.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a normal dude until Wolverine chopped him to pieces.
Yeah, then Wolverine chopped him to pieces, he became a cyborg, and he became leading anti-mutant force guy.
Yeah.
The Deathstroke being a villain is kind of weird, but it's not as weird as this next story, which is Transformers The Last Knight, Transformers 5, for those who keep track, five Transformers movies.
Michael Bay loves Transformers.
Five.
Have they yet to have one that was like a commercial flop?
No.
Yeah.
No. I mean, everything has
They've all been critical flops. They've all been terrible.
Oh, no, I'm only talking commercial, sadly.
No, money-wise, they've made billions.
So the next one is called Transformers The Last Knight. And they have announced that Liam Garrigan, who played King Arthur on Once Upon a Time, is playing King Arthur in this.
You know how, like, people are on Star Trek and stuff, like, worry that they might get typecast as, like, genre sci-fi roles?
Yeah, sure.
If you actually play the same person literally twice, I feel like you're asking for it.
I feel like this guy was a TV actor on Once Upon a Time, and now he gets to play King Arthur in a major movie.
Yeah.
He doesn't care what they cast him
as. Do you not jump when Michael Bay asks you to be in his billion-dollar movie?
How much do I need that pool?
You must need that pool really badly.
Yeah.
Really, really badly.
I mean...
But, yeah, so apparently... This is somehow going to, like, Excalibur and all this stuff is going to tie into the Transformers.
I mean, they're having Arthur and they're also having Merlin.
It's got to be trying to tie in the Visionaries.
You know, Randy, the, at no point have the Transformers movies ever done what you would call, like, fan service in the sense of, that's what we really wanted.
Yeah.
Other than, like, oh, they wanted Devastator, we'll give them Devastator.
And they wanted Dinobots, they had Dinobots.
Right. I guess it's just always, like, some crap-ass version.
That wasn't Devastator, so. That was dumb.
Yeah,
but being the people who like those, people who are going to see those movies, they're pretty happy with the half-assed Devastator they're getting.
It's true.
But I feel like Randy's right. This is the start of the Visionary stuff. This is...
Visionaries?
The old 80s property that they're doing in the shared universe. Mask and...
Remember when we talked about that shared universe, we were like, how the Visionaries fit in? Well, I guess this is how they fit in. Which is to say, not at all.
It's so weird.
Brian Vaughn and Michael Chabon are like, let's do this.
Yeah. Yeah,
is Bay directing it?
I don't think so. I think he's just producing.
Oh, is he not?
I don't know.
I was just wondering how close are the spheres of Brian Vaughn, one of the great writers in comics right now, and Michael Bay?
One of the worst directors of all time. I don't know. I don't know.
All right. Just curious.
It's very, very interesting. All right. Image Comics is, by all reports, relocating from San Francisco to Portland.
Oh, right.
This is just sort of inside baseball kind of interesting, but... That puts a lot of the comics industry in Portland. So
if there was a terrorist attack?
Yeah, you could take out the entire comics industry. Because, I mean, Marvel and DC are both... Marvel's in New York. DC is in L.A. But Image is just, like, 12 guys. It's like their marketing staff and their publishing staff. But it's like all their creators are freelance. So, but Image, Dark Horse, Oni Press, and the CBLDF are all in Portland, as are Brian Michael Bendis, Matt Fraction, Kelly Sue DeConnick, any number of creators.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is interesting that Portland has become sort of the hub of comics.
Yeah. It it is to comics what New York is to superheroes in Marvel.
Yeah. I also want to mention
that this Galactus is going to attack Portland.
Yes. This is a little weird. No, but like Indie Galactus.
Who's Indie Galactus? Somebody from Scott Pilgrim or something?
Yeah, probably.
The Evil X's?
Yeah. There's a new show coming on Disney XD starting on October 3rd. It's online, I think, today. It is called Milo Murphy's Law.
Uh-huh.
Or not today. It's a month from now. Milo Murphy's Law. It is interesting for several reasons. One is that it is Weird Al Yankovic is doing the theme song and original music for it and one of the voices. And the creators are the guys who did Phineas and Ferb.
Which I've never watched.
Oh, man, it's so good. It's so good. And this looks like a lot of fun. You can watch the trailer now, and it's a Weird Al song. And it's this kid who basically seems like crazy things keep happening. Like, the credit sequence is him walking along, and, like, trees are falling behind him, and stuff's falling from the sky, and he's just, like, narrowly avoiding it. Uh-huh. And it's like this good luck, bad luck thing. Like, things happen around him, but he always manages to dodge his way out of it. He has some kind of, like, magical backpack that lets him, like, have stuff to deal with. He's got a couple of friends. It's got a good voice cast, and it's going to involve, like, aliens and extra-dimensional travel and all this kind of stuff. And if you liked Phineas and Ferb, it looks like it's going to be a lot of fun.
Is Weird Al voicing the lead character?
I think he's the lead character. I'm not 100% sure. But just kind of a weird little story.
Sounds like a good conglomeration of creators, though.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. I didn't know about it until recently, and then I saw it pop up on, like, IO9 or something.
And you just can't stop talking about Disney XD, Disney XD.
I love Disney XD. I also have Rebels, which is starting again soon.
No.
Finally, sad news, Gene Wilder has died.
Yeah.
I'm sure if you have your Facebook feed is anything like mine, it was full of Gene Wilder tributes.
I have to say, I like when that happens.
Me too.
I don't like when somebody dies. Yeah. But when it's like so universal like that and you can just feel the sort of the love outpouring.
Yeah.
Do you know what's weird? I don't know if you remember this, but like maybe a month ago, I was randomly thinking about Gene Wilder and I posted a bunch of clips from his stuff.
Yeah. You killed him, Dave.
I killed him by posting a clip of the Frisco Kid.
Yep.
which, by the way, underseen movie that people should see. I don't know if it's not great, but it's a lot of fun. Have you ever seen it, Randy?
No.
This is like it's a comedic Western, but it is not Blazing Saddles style comedy. It's more character-based comedy. He is a rabbi who's like traveling through the Old West and ends up sort of having to road trip it, think Midnight Run style,
sure,
with Harrison Ford, who's like kind of an outlaw, kind of rogue. And I don't know if it was like shortly after Star Wars or actually slightly before, but it's right that same era for him. I feel like it's a few years afterwards.
Okay.
He was not quite full on I'm Harrison Ford yet. It was pre-Indiana Jones for sure.
Sure.
Anyway, it's a lot of fun. It's beyond just there's definitely humor to be had in it, but it is also like a sort of, I think as a kid when I like had very little knowledge of Judaism, this was kind of like my glimpse of like, you know, a guy who was both like very devout, but also had like the kind of the classic Jewish sense of humor, that sort of Mel Brooksian sort of thing. And and you know how like Wilder kind of like could bring like pathos to a moment, you know, even in like the midst of comedy.
Yep.
There's a lot of that in there. And that's one of the things I'll miss most about him is that way he could swing around from like kind of really, you know, like kind of sweet or melancholy to ranting crazy guy or, you know, if you picture
Young Frankenstein,
that's got to be his greatest.
Those are classics. I don't know. The argument is either Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles, or the other one, the other one's escaping me. But
Willy Wonka.
Willy Wonka. Yeah. Yes, those are the three big ones.
You're overlooking one of his best ones, and that's See No Evil, Hear No Evil.
You know, I have a huge fondness for See No Evil, Hear No Evil, which is him and Richard Pryor. They also worked together on
Silver Streak,
and the one that they're in prison.
Stir Crazy, yeah.
Which I've not seen those.
I watched all of those all the time when I was a kid. Like a lot of people have been saying, I think like anybody's like, maybe like 35, 40 and up.
Yeah.
He was a comedic touchstone.
Yeah.
If you were a kid in the 70s or 80s. And like, I watched everything and I liked all of those things. I think some of them didn't age as well. They weren't all Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
But his performances are kind of like always elevate, even like sort of somewhat middling material sometimes
isn't
becomes.
He also in The Woman in Red.
Woman in Red, yeah. I think he married that woman.
No, Steven Seagal married Kelly LeBrock.
No, this is a different one. This is not.
You mean the gal who's like his wife in it?
I think so.
It's possible. I don't know.
I thought I heard somebody saying something like that. I mean, he's been married for 25 years.
Right.
And that was one of these was going around, people saying like he's with Gilda now. And they're like, well, he was married to Gilda for 5 years. He's been married to his current wife for 25 years.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's a good point. I hadn't considered it.
It was just, you know, they were both icons of comedy in the 70s. Yeah. And so I understand that instinct to like, you know, just kind of when you're just imagining, you're trying, it's really us trying to make ourselves feel better about losing somebody.
It was Kelly LeBrock.
Okay. It must be someone else on that movie because I saw somebody mention it. Or someone was wrong. I don't know.
I was remembering how the woman in red starts. Do you remember this, Randy?
No.
He is out on the ledge of a building, like suicidal style, naked, except for a pillow he's got at waist level. And I think it's sort of like, he's like, you're probably wondering how I got here, or whatever. And so the rest of the movie is a flashback.
I mean, that movie has Gilda Radner and,
maybe they're talking about Gilda Radner?
Charles Grodin.
I assume they were talking about, maybe that's meant, yeah, they meant that's
where. He was like, that came out years after, like, SNL's, her heyday on SNL.
I don't know. I don't know. I also know that people have been posting about, it's not available anywhere but on YouTube, Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother.
Yeah, yeah.
Which has him and Marty Feldman. And I think maybe Terry Garr. It's like the Young Frankenstein team back together again. So there's all kinds of like undiscovered gems. I have definitely not seen everything he's done. He only did 22 films. I have stuff to watch and maybe
you know,
in tribute.
You know what's rough, and I had forgotten this, if I even knew it, is that he died of complications related to Alzheimer's, and that's rough.
Yeah.
I particularly feel for his surviving wife.
Yeah. Also, just to tie this back into comics, there is that great, I don't know who did the art, but there's a great fan art that's going around of him as Iron Fist and Richard Pryor as Luke Cage.
Yes, it's so good.
And it's like, that would have been, that would have been amazing.
I saw that some years ago.
Yeah.
But it was, of course, making the rounds again. And it does, you know, it looks like, it wasn't, but it looks like one of those old Mad Magazine artists, you know, like Mort Drucker or one of those guys, or even Davis when he was doing stuff for him. But it's a great piece. I believe sort of, keying off like Stir Crazy.
Yeah, Stir Crazy, definitely.
Yeah.
All right. We are going to be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. We were talking comics for the week of Wednesday, August 31st. It is a fifth week, so there's not as many comics to talk about. I was able to find some gems. I know we all found some stuff to read. And actually, some of my favorite books came out this week. So I'm going to start with a book that I was a little wary of. It is Suicide Special War Crimes number 1.
Squad.
What did I say?
You said Suicide Special.
Suicide Squad. Suicide Squad.
You left out a word.
All right.
You left out an important word.
Suicide Squad Special War Crimes number 1. It is a one-shot by the creator of Suicide Squad, John Ostrander, and art by Gus Vasquez and Carlos Rodriguez. The art is merely okay, sometimes maybe not even quite there, but it didn't matter to me because this was Ostrander writing the Squad again.
And classic.
This was back to my favorite version of the Squad. It's a one-shot where an American notable is kidnapped by a European super team, and the Squad is sent in to get him back, and from there, there's all kinds of stuff that happens, you know, typical twists and turns of an Ostrander Squad.
It's got those moral quandaries, you know, this guy's almost like sort of, I don't know if he was meant to be like an analog to like Dick Cheney or something like that.
No, he's definitely an analog to Dick Cheney.
He was, because, they basically are pinning an unnamed war that is clearly like a Gulf War kind of thing.
He's basically taken to The Hague for international war crimes.
Yes, and he's very arrogant. He was the Secretary
of Defense. That's how you know it's fantasy, because he's being prosecuted.
He was the Secretary of Defense in a previous administration, is what they keep saying.
Right.
And, he's standing in for all those guys. He's also, his security is like Black Mountain security. Right, so, it's...
what is that, Blackwater?
Yes.
Yeah.
They're Z now, Dave.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot they rebranded.
Yeah. At any rate, the team is sort of the movie team. It is Deadshot, Harley Quinn, Boomerang, El Diablo, Rick Flag, and a dude named Mad Dog, who none of us had ever heard of.
Yep.
Waller is Waller. And Boomerang feels like Boomerang to me again. Deadshot feels like Deadshot. Like, this is my squad.
Right. His Boomerang is a little bit more his Boomerang.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit more with the ridiculous Australian slang, a little bit more colorful than he's kind of become.
I was worried because I wasn't sure Ostrander having to deal with Harley Quinn was going to work. I felt like Harley Quinn changed the squad quite a bit, but he makes good use of her. So if you're a fan of the current squad, or if you like the really, really great Suicide Squad that Ostrander did, this is worth a look.
Mm-hmm.
Dave, what is your pick?
My pick is one of those rare issues, although more frequent now. It's maybe back on track of Afterlife with Archie.
More frequently, like every 2 months. It's not back on track.
That's more frequent.
It's bi-monthly than every 6 months.
That's true. That's true.
So the previous issue was essentially a one-shot, and this is also a one-shot. I feel like essentially arc two on this book has been like that. It is still in that universe wherein zombies took over Riverdale and stuff like that. But this one, I don't think it's probably giving away too much to say, is a vampire story.
Yeah, okay.
And that actually spans a long span of time and highlights Josie and the Pussycats.
Yep.
Without getting too much into the specifics, let's just say that they have been around longer than their 90 or their 2000s incarnation, you know, with a sliding time scale. They are a modern band, but it turns out they have been around before. And there's a very interesting story going on behind it. Like the other stuff, this is dark. It's like R-rated stuff weaving in and out of here, or like hard PG-13 at least. No language or nudity like there, but sexual suggestions, violent stuff. But it's written once again by Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa, and it's got that sort of trademark sophistication that he's brought to all of it, as well as great art from Francesco Francavilla, who's because his art has that sort of noirish look, he's really good at evoking different eras, and you see like 20s, 30s, 50s, and 60s. There's a span of time covered in this story.
Huh.
It's a good venue, it's a good playground for his style. Anyway, it's another good standalone issue. The previous one was, to me, their most kind of Game of Thrones, Thronesiest one, with its sort of some shocking twists and reveals about Reggie. Yes, look for this one. Look for the demonic Josie and the Pussycats cover on it with the bats.
That's extremely striking.
It's a great cover from Francesco. I had a blast with it, and would just like to see more of the series. That's all I ask, Roberto.
Nick, what's your pick?
I have an annual, and I have the all-new Wolverine annual number one.
So this leads to a discussion we were having earlier.
Okay.
That annuals are terrible, and that people should stop doing them. That we literally 20 minutes before we read this, right. I was like, why do we do this? There's not been a great annual since like the 80s.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if any of our listeners have annuals that they like.
I feel like there has been an annual that's been good. I just can't name it right now.
The Armageddon 2001 annuals.
Yeah, okay. Actually, I did like some of those annuals at the time. Yeah.
And we're the DC 1 Millions. Those were kind
of one of the things we were talking about.
That wasn't annuals.
Most annuals, I would say like 90% of annuals are space filling stinkers.
Yeah, well, it's like the fifth week events,
and they're bloated.
Yeah,
so they like even drag out the story, and then they cost you more money.
Yeah,
and before Nick gets on to why this one is an exception, I will say I know that there have been other exceptions. They show up every once in a while. We were kind of thinking that it might be interesting that, you know, one of the most famous annuals that there was Avengers annual
number ten.
Ah, whatever. Was the one that was drawn by Michael Golden. And had the X-Men in it, and it had Rogue, and it was the one where she stole the powers of Ms. Marvel.
Yeah.
Basically became Rogue as we know her. Had an amazing fight between the Avengers and the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. Like, yep. One of the best super comic book fights I've ever seen. And amazing art from Michael Golden. And it established Rogue, and we were thinking, what if the annuals were where sort of like things would change a little bit? Not always huge things, but like new characters might get introduced that would be kind of ongoing characters, or sort of some major sort of event or character development would happen in them.
Well, it used to be they would start or end a story with an annual, and I kind of liked that. And that sort of leads back into this All-New Wolverine annual, which is kind of a capper to the first year of All-New Wolverine.
It is. It is a capper to the first year of All-New Wolverine. It's also just a really good story.
Well, this is a story that could only... I think this is a story that can only be told in an annual. It is sort of a standalone goofy story.
It is kind of a goofy story. It's basically... I'm trying to think...
You can spoil the premise, because it's established really early on.
If you have seen the movie Vice Versa, or something
or
like
any
that.
Of those movies, yeah. Freaky Friday...
Where, like, a parent swaps with their kid.
But basically, this is Laura X-23 swapping bodies with Spider-Gwen.
Okay.
Across different...
Across dimensions.
Are they just pals?
They don't know each other.
They don't know each other
at all.
Oh,
weird. Okay.
So, and it's them sort of exploring their each of their power sets, not really understanding... and just the humor story that kind of goes along with this. There is a cool, you know, through line through it, and a villain that they have to face.
Which is a really good villain.
It is a really good villain.
It's a new character, and I like what they did.
But I like Tom Taylor's just... He gets these characters, and he explores the different sort of facets of the characters. Like, Laura as Spider-Gwen is, you know... Even in the other body, she's kind of stoic and not really... fun.
Yeah.
While Spider-Gwen Gwen is a...
Although you say the overall issue has a fair amount of humor to it.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Oh, it does.
You know what's interesting about this? Tom Taylor initially struck me as a guy who was himself rather serious. His Injustice comics, although they did have some very fun scenes in it.
They were fun.
It's true. But they were also... It was serious apocalyptic stuff. And then he had done those Boba Fett minis and Dark Horse before then. Anyway, just in my mind, I was thinking, oh, this guy is going to write kind of like serious angsty
But see, that's the thing. I don't think that's what he's ever been. I think he's what he's got is a very rare breed of thing, which is that he can do dark stuff with a sense of humor. And that is a skill very few people have.
Right.
But I love this issue. It opens up with Gabby talking to Jonathan, their pet Wolverine.
That's a pet Wolverine.
Yeah.
Given to him by Squirrel Girl.
Given to him by Squirrel Girl.
Who's Gabby?
Gabby is the
clone.
She's X-23 clone. She's basically the new Molly from Runaways.
Yes. Right, right. And she's under the wing of X-23.
She's basically dealing with Jonathan, and then X-23 runs to the room and then runs out a window.
Yep.
And it's just hilarious, and I think it just goes from there. There's jokes, there's gags, but there's also a really good story with some great character
moments. You know, I think one of the reasons this works as an annual and why others don't. This is actually the main creative team of the book. It's Tom Taylor and Marcio Takara on art. Takara's art is fantastic.
I also want to say there is a appearance from a character in the Spider-Gwen universe that I was not aware of.
Sort of an appearance, yes.
I did not know there was a Reed Richards in Spider-Gwen's universe.
Yeah, their Reed Richards
and
is cool.
I think that it's a very cool version of that character. But yeah, no... There's a lot to like in here, and if you're not reading All-New Wolverine...
That art is really sharp as you're flipping through it.
Oh, yeah.
Who's the artist again?
Marcio Takara.
Not somebody I know?
Honestly, I think if you haven't read any of All-New Wolverine, pick this issue up. It'd give you kind of a good kind of all-around
primer.
Look at the thing, and I would suggest picking up the trades.
Yeah, I was going to say, then pick up the trades.
It's extremely worth it.
It's one of my favorite books.
The cover, I'm going to point out to people, is at least one of the two covers, or maybe three covers
there
that they had.
There were three covers this week.
But the one I'm looking at right now is a Reservoir Dogs riff that has Wolverine, X-23, Gabby, Spider-Gwen, and
Jonathan, the Wolverine.
The Wolverine. There's a little chubby Wolverine walking down.
All wearing sunglasses.
Yeah, just add little green bag, and you're there.
Yep. Nick, what is your backup pick?
My backup pick is Spider-Man number 7. And this is the Miles Morales-focused Spider-Man. And I haven't been reading the series. I really haven't.
I've dropped in on a couple issues.
I've always found it to look pretty when I thumb through it. Just never really catches my eye. But I've liked what Marvel has done with a lot of their Civil War tie-ins. And this is definitely a Civil War tie-in. Dealing with Miles, dealing with the sort of Hulk stuff, like... him getting the vision that Hulk was going to kill everyone.
Right.
So him dealing with that and sort of his parents kind of trying to explore, find out who he is. Like, they know he has a secret that they haven't told him. And it's just, there's some really cool stuff going on in here. Jessica Jones makes an appearance, which I thought was really neat. There's another sort of up-and-coming superhero that Miles has a relationship with. Just friends that I think is just a very unexplored kind of dynamic that I haven't seen in a while, and it's interesting. So I like a lot of what Bendis is bringing to the table here, and his dialogue, which sometimes feels a little off, really feels well for a teenager. And he, since he brought so
honestly,
much
he's always been pretty good at that.
Brought so much of that with Ultimate Spider-Man to the table. I think with Miles, it completely works, and it makes him feel very real. So I'm going to continue on kind of reading this, and I'm really tempted to go back and just kind of pick up some of the stuff I haven't read
yet. You know what's interesting to me is that Bendis is sometimes good at doing something that's not easy to pull off nowadays, where there's not a lot of done-in-one issues, but he will... You can walk in sometimes on his single issues and get a very good, satisfying read. You know, I randomly read one of his Invincible Iron Man some months ago, and I was like, oh, this is a good issue. As it happened, by the way, it was one of those ones that introduced, like, Riri Williams?
Yep.
Is it? Who's going to be the new Iron Man. And I was like, oh, that was a really cool issue. As it happened, I didn't like the next issue. but to give him his credit, what impressed me is that I didn't feel lost in the issue. I was able to get in on what was going on and feel like I got a very satisfying read. Sometimes
even the threads that have been obviously going on for a little while now, when I jumped in,
kind of picked up.
I knew exactly what was going on, and he didn't really have to give me very many cues, just enough that it made it sense.
I've already talked about how I like Civil War II. I need you guys to stop making me want to have to say nice things about Bendis.
And I will say the art here, which I'm not familiar with this artist, Nico Leon.
Oh, okay.
Fantastic art. Very much in sort of Sarah Pacelli, Vane, and all that other stuff that Bendis just gets to work with some very talented, amazing people.
You know, Randy, we were just yesterday talking about how Bendis, we had to give him credit for successfully kind of putting his money where his mouth is as far as diversity goes.
He basically put Luke Cage into the spot where he's at. He created Jessica Jones. He created Miles Morales.
Yep. I wanted to get one more thing out of you today.
All right. He's
you're off the hook now.
Thank you. Now I can hate Bendis again.
Yes.
All right. So my backup pick is also a Spider-Man book, but it is Amazing Spider-Man number 17. I've been picking Amazing Spider-Man off and on for a while now. And this new story, The Dead No More, is another one of these Dan Slott things that's like, sounds like a terrible idea. It's going to be about all these characters coming back to life and the Jackal's involved. And the Jackal's never been an interesting villain, not once.
What? No. He was originally good.
No, Jackal's a terrible villain.
First Clone Saga thing was awesome.
Jackal's a terrible villain.
Crazy old man with the blade thing. Nick, you're looking at me like I'm crazy, but I'm not talking about your crap-ass 90s Clone Saga.
You're talking about the 70s Clone Saga.
You're not the actual one. I don't know. I've never been a fan of the Jackal.
He's a weird guy.
But they've got a new take on him. I like the new costume where it's like more of an Egyptian thing where he's got like the Anubis mask.
Yep.
And that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, it was a good update.
And there's a new Electro introduced in this issue, and I... Electro, sorry. And I don't know why I didn't think of this, but they had actually already introduced this character and, in fact, shown her in the previous issue. And I'm like, oh, of course that's who the new Electro is. But it's a bit of a deep cut in the Spider-Man run. This also brings back Hobie Brown, a.k.a. the Prowler, who's been playing Spider-Man for Peter Parker sometimes. And we have seen him not much at all in this book. They introduced the idea, and then we haven't really seen him. So this issue is sort of a focus on Hobie Brown and the new Electro. And... I really like what they're doing. Peter Parker is almost not in. He's got a little guest starring bit, but this is more or less setting up the Dead No More stuff. And I love the new take on the new villain. I love seeing the Prowler be the Prowler, be sort of the guy who uses his thieving skills for good. And it also features a couple notable big bad Spider-Man villains. So worth a read. And this looks like another story in the line of, say, Spider-Verse or Superior Spider-Man, where I'm like, why are you doing this? Oh, because it's good.
Yep. Where, like, a slightly outrageous concept is going to result in good stories.
Yep.
You know what's interesting? What I kind of like about what they've been doing with the Prowler lately?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember, like, even kind of liking him when he was showing up back in, like, the David Michelinie McFarlane era. He was, you know, occasionally showing up there. But now he's from the Ultimate Universe. He was, what, Miles Morales' uncle?
Yeah.
And it seems like playing a major role in Amazing Spider-Man.
Yep.
He's essentially cemented a much stronger role as part of key Spider-Man mythology.
Yeah.
So the same way that Batman has his circle of allies and enemies, Prowler has now kind of, he already technically was in there, but he's kind of much more solid now, I feel like. Yeah. And I like that. He's a good character.
All right. Also on my list this week, Saga number 37, which starts a new storyline. People will be glad to have Saga back. Ms. Marvel number 10, which continues the great work they've been doing on Civil War II. Astonishing Ant-Man number 11, which, now that we know why he's in jail, we're actually seeing sort of the fallout from that. This looks like we're wrapping toward the end of the one-year story that Spencer's been doing on Ant-Man. The second issue of Predator vs. Judge Dredd vs. Aliens, which is just as fun as the first one.
Yeah.
Really, really fun. And has some callbacks to the Judge Dredd Incubus story, which I liked.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. Just mentioned, basically. Sort of the Dredd.
15 years ago?
Dredd knows about aliens. That's kind of what it was.
I mean, that's cool, though.
Star Wars Han Solo number 3, which is another great Han Solo being a cool pilot and a cool smuggler. I've been really enjoying that book. Lazarus number 24, which continues the big war story called Cull they've been doing. Two new heavy metal books. Skip to the End, which is about a rock star who sort of crossed over into the afterlife. And Reincarnate, which is about a private detective who seems like he might have other lives, or at least ghosts advising him. Jim Thompson's The Killer Inside Me is a classic crime novel being translated by our own Austin local Devin Faraci. Isn't he Austin local?
I don't know.
I don't know. He works for Birth Movies Death.
I'm going to go ahead and say yes.
It's a crime book set in Texas. And then collection-wise, there is the collection of the first four issues of Black Panther, along with some extras, and the first appearance of Black Panther from Fantastic Four. The Star Wars Shattered Empire hardcover, which is Rucka's entire four-issue story of Poe Dameron's parents, basically.
Yep.
One of whom is a fighter pilot, the other of whom is one of Han Solo's commandos. It also includes that C-3PO one-shot that Dave and Nick were all over a few months back, and is a cool deluxe hardcover. And finally, if you have kids, or if you're a fan of Captain Underpants, Dave Pilkey has a new book called Dog Man that is coming out, and we have that. Dave, what else is on your reading list this week?
Yeah, actually, I was going to say something about Shattered Empire. The interesting thing is that the Star Wars one, when we read that, had not come out yet. We didn't know. We were like,
We didn't know who Poe Dameron was.
We didn't know who Poe Dameron was. So we're like, is this the parents of Rey?
Yeah.
We don't know. We didn't know who any of the characters were going to be. So it's kind of cool. Like, it functions as a sort of final battle in the Jedi era.
Yeah.
Once you know what the deal is, you're like, oh, where would somebody like Poe Dameron get his skill set from? Oh, it's because his parents are two badasses.
Yeah, and then one of the issues is Han Solo, one of the issues is Leia, one of the issues is Luke. They all get a spotlight.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, it was fun.
Let's see. I think you got most of the stuff I was going to hit, but I did want to mention, fourth issue of Future Quest.
Yep.
Is out. That is the, of course, the mashup of all the Hanna-Barbera action-adventure stuff, Johnny Quest and so on.
Yep.
Did we mention this one yet, Randy?
Nope.
This is one of the crazier things I've heard. Is it an app game or a Steam game?
I think it's an app game.
Okay. Well, whatever they get, World of Tanks.
It's downloadable on, like, Xbox and stuff, too, so yeah. Who knows.
This is the World of Tanks comic written by Garth Ennis. Yep. Yes, the creator of Preacher is writing the app-based comic World of Tanks. It seemed to be very much in the mold of his many other war comics he's done, and fully uncensored. I saw the F-bomb dropped in there. I saw Garth Ennis' violence. I have not had a chance to read it yet, but if you are a follower of his war comics in general, probably want to check it out. It looks like it's pretty classic Ennis, and not some crazy, super weird video game LARP.
And the art is by Judge Dredd co-creator Carlos Esquerra.
Yep. When you think about the legendary qualities thrown in there, I bet those guys made a bazillion dollars off of that.
We're like, you know what? It's great that you guys are a big thing in the UK, but come over here and write our video game comics.
That sounds right. And this is just something that I may read because Gotham Academy is one of those books that I keep wanting to like and I just cannot fully sink into. But they have an annual this week. And it mentions a detective club on the cover, so I'm gonna maybe give this one a shot.
You're hoping this will break through the annual.
It might be another one.
It is by the regular creative team of Clunan and Fletcher.
The one Gotham Academy issue that I really plugged into was one of those specials they did whenever the Joker had Jokerized like the whole city.
Yeah,
I forget what that thing was called. But that was the one where they spent the whole issue in the gym basically telling ghost stories about where they thought the Joker came from. Super awesome issue. So maybe this one shot magic will – lightning will strike twice.
Maybe so.
Nick, got anything else?
Yeah, I've got just three more. A new issue, number 10 of Nova this week, which kind of digs deep into the Nova mythology, and some cool stuff is afoot in that book. So –
Did I hear? Are there like some big changes or a few reveals?
There's some reveals in there.
Cosmic Marvel stuff is afoot.
Yes, so definitely be on the lookout for that. The 13th issue of Uncanny Avengers, which ties into Civil War II, and sees the new Captain America, Steve Rogers, take up arms against Cable, which may or may not be a good thing. And then, because we need more annuals, there was... and I've actually never tried this book before, so this is DC Comics Bombshells Annual. And I have to say, it's done by the same creative team, so Marguerite Bennett, and I don't know if it's the same artist. It's,
I think it's a different artist.
Elsa Chartier.
I'll say this. One of the things about the annuals for the Bombshells that makes it somewhat different is Bombshells is collecting the digital series.
Yeah.
So basically every issue is the same.
Right. But this is sort of cool. It's about Amanda Waller tasking a sort of agent to go and recover Barbara Gordon, who is now a vampire.
Okay, sure.
From the swamps of Louisiana.
Uh-huh.
And there's a trio of women who or another two have sort of joined Barbara Gordon, so it's...
Birds of Prey?
No, actually, it's the Enchantress and Ravager.
Huh.
And it weaves a really fun tale, sort of Barbara Gordon's backstory as kind of a pilot and a bomber in the war.
Hmm. What I've noticed is that they've kind of built their own sort of mythology in the Bombshells thing.
Yeah.
So you see somewhat unusual team-ups and stuff that... It very much works within the set, the World War II setting they've established, yeah. But they're not always kind of the obvious ones.
Okay.
No, I actually was very impressed with all the sort of world building that Marguerite Bennett is able to do in here, and the art is gorgeous. It's sort of in that, I mean, I hate to compare it to Darwin Cook, but it's very Darwin Cook, Dave Bullock type stylings, mm-hmm. and great cartooning. It has Killer Croc in it as well, as a really cool part of the team.
Oh, interesting.
And I don't know. I was impressed with it. And it's got a fantastic cover by Terry Dodson.
Yeah, it's really good.
But yeah, no, that's all I had.
It is shocking to me that the Bombshells thing spun out of essentially a pinup statue line, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, it was meant to be kind of a merchandising and statue line.
Well, I from the outset, I was saying they should really do more in that universe because it seemed like an interesting universe to explore stories in.
Yeah.
All right, we'll be back in just a minute to talk about TV, movies, and podcasts. We now return you to another installment of Nick Was Right Theater, already in progress, as Randy catches up to things Nick had recommended to him somewhere between 6 to 8 months ago. Because... I randomly, and it's been on my queue for a while, but I finally got around to watching the first two episodes of The Good Guys.
Uh-huh.
And it's great.
Yeah.
It's so good. It is, so this is a show set in Dallas. I think it was filmed in Dallas.
It was filmed in Dallas.
It it was on Fox?
Was it on Fox?
Okay.
It's Colin Hanks.
Colin Hanks and Bradley Whitford.
Yeah.
Are the two leads. And basically, Colin Hanks is this sort of straight shooter detective who had a history of sort of doing unsmart politically things like correcting his captain's grammar in front of the chief. And like he points out that a cold case report was really done badly. Like it's like looks like a third grader and it's his lieutenant's report.
Yeah.
So basically he's managed to get himself busted down to small time crimes where he's basically babysitting this ex-hero cop from the 70s who was part of a partnership that rescued the governor's son like 25 years ago. This old cop is Bradley Whitford. He's got a magnificent little mustache, wears his sunglasses. He is like a 70s cop.
He's constantly drunk.
He sleeps with a witness in the first episode. He is definitely an old school kind of cop, one of these, cop show cops.
Right.
And it's sort of a buddy comedy about a guy trying to live in the real world and be a cop in the real world and a guy who thinks, small-time property crime is going to turn into, like, big Michael Bay adventures, which they often do. like a trying to find someone's stolen humidifier turns into a cross with the world's second-best assassin and drug runners and all that kind of stuff.
Is it slapsticky?
At times it can be.
It's got a humorous bent to it. It's kind of like a riff on Magnum P.I. and all those kind of shows in the 70s.
Yeah.
Like, every time there's a little Chiron that shows up, like, Dallas, Texas or whatever,
yeah.
There's, like, bullet sound effects.
Yeah.
And then they like to jump around in time where they'll be, like, 22 minutes earlier. And when they do that special effect, there's, like, the sound of a revolver spinning.
Yeah.
So it's definitely, like, It's not sledgehammer type, like wacky
or police squad or whatever.
No, but it's definitely got a little nod to the humor of it all. It's by Matt Nix, who did Burn Notice, and it feels if anything more like that. It's got
okay.
It's a mix of sort of it's fun action adventure, and it is very funny. And
I think it all comes down to the two leads.
Yeah, Bradley Whitford and Colin Hanks are great. Colin Hanks is playing the closest thing he's played to a Tom Hanks role here.
Yeah, it's true.
Like it feels very Tom Hanks. It's a lot of fun, and each episode that I've watched so far has been really entertaining.
I'm sure he watched Dragnet to build for that.
Yes, exactly. I'm sure he did a lot of research on Dragnet. But I was delighted to find, even though it's a one-season wonder, that because it was Fox, there's 20 episodes to watch. So that's a good thing to put on your queue. Also, and this one I know Dave recommended. Maybe I'm not sure if Nick recommended to me.
No,
but,
it's Dave.
But I finally watched Creed.
Oh, yeah.
And that movie was great.
Yep.
I've never seen Rocky.
It was one of my favorite movies of the whole year.
I've never seen Rocky. Mm-hmm. I've seen Rocky 3 and Rocky 4.
Yep.
Because I was a kid in the 80s.
Yes.
But I've never seen the original Rocky. Despite that, I was totally taken in by the story of like Apollo Creed's son and him wanting to be his own thing. And it's Michael B. Jordan is fantastic in it. Stallone is actually great in it.
Yep.
And Felicia Rashad has a really good role.
Yeah.
And then, was it Tessa Thompson? Isn't that the girl?
I think that's right.
She has her own story, too. We talked about this
early
on.
Who's
she
about to play?
I don't remember.
Oh, Valkyrie, right?
She's Valkyrie, that's right.
In Thor.
Yeah. But she's her story of sort of being an up-and-coming singer who's looking at progressive deafness and, you know, it's like the B-side of the movie. Like, there's a whole movie there about this girl who's, like, trying to make it in music, and she gets involved with this boxer.
Yep.
And I really liked that. I liked where it went. It's a really engaging movie, and I dug it a lot.
Right from the first 5 minutes, I remember I was into it, which shows his son as a kid,
young Adonis Creed. Yes.
Yeah. And just the way this is edited, he's like in a juvie hall. You see, he's getting in fights with all these kids.
Yep.
And then his Apollo's wife, his stepmom.
Yeah.
Who he's never known because, like...
he was the product of an affair, and he sort of got lost in the system when his mom died.
And his dad died, basically, before...
No, his mom died. Well, and his dad died,
And his dad died, too, because what's his name? The Russian killed him.
Yeah.
In Rocky IV. But, so he kind of grew up, with...
He grew up as a kid in like foster homes and clearly in like juvenile detention.
Yep.
Like he was getting in trouble. And then Felicia Rashad's character shows up when he's a teenager, like a young teenager, like maybe even like 10.
Yeah, he feels like he could be like 10 or 11.
And basically he becomes this child of privilege.
Yeah.
And
But it was actually, I was just to briefly cut back to that opening scene. She says she'd like to take him in.
Yeah.
It's this tender scene where she's kind of getting through to this kid right after he was in a fight, by the way. And he kind of, in talking to her, he calms down for the first time, and he says, she's like, I was married to your dad, and because he's like, I don't have a dad.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, what was his name?
Yeah.
And then they cut to the title, silent titling, and it was like, I could tell immediately it was going to be well directed.
Well, that's one of their notable things. They do this when they show the fighters, and a little like pop up comes up and gives their stats.
I thought that was really cool.
This is Ryan Coogler is the director. He's a young guy.
Is he?
And he's directing Black Panther.
Yeah.
And just based on this, like I would love for them to do like Marvel Universe style stats pop up when somebody shows up, like when we first see Crossbones in Civil War. If a little thing popped up that like showed you his name, his
kill
height and weight, his kill
something.
Ratio or whatever, and like, you know, some note like really hates Captain America.
Yeah.
It'd be something like that. And that would be super cool. And I don't know if they'll bring that into Black Panther or not, but I would love it because it's a great way to get information across. That's fun. Yeah. It reminds me of something Guy Ritchie would do.
Yeah. And it kind of like as Adonis goes through these different fighters, you kind of see the progression, the level progression of them in a way. And also, of course, there's a great scene early on where he gets kind of his hat handed to him by this dude who's out of his league.
Yeah.
Because he's got natural talent, but he's overconfident.
What's funny is this is that kind of thing, the pop-ups and little mm-hmm. little bits of there's humor and stuff in this. This is very much a serious, like this should have been an Academy Award winning movie.
Yeah.
And
the original Rocky was.
Yeah, I know. This should have been nominated. It was really, really good. But at the same time, it's not so direly serious. It's got moments of lightness, and it's quick on its feet.
Right.
Yeah, it's really, really good, and I definitely recommend people watch it.
To me, it is the closest thing that there's in the entire series that it's gotten to the original movie.
Yeah.
It is still slightly maybe more pop than that.
Yeah.
But as far as like having some little more dramatic weight to it, and characters that I feel are a little bit richer, it's my second favorite, maybe.
Yeah, it's really, really good. The other movie I watched, because I guess just on Blu-ray, which is one of our favorites, Midnight Run. Because I've watched this movie dozens of times, and it's one of my favorites.
Quintessential buddy comedy.
It's in my favorite seven. It has, the Blu-ray has so many special features. It's got a special interview, and like relatively new, because all the actors look really old.
Yeah.
With Robert De Niro, Charles Grodin, Joe Pantoliano, John Ashton, and Yaphet Kotto.
Mm-hmm.
All interviewed. And what's interesting, strikes me about that is Ashton's sort of laid back, funny guy. He's so much.
Does he play?
He's the bounty hunter. Marvin.
Marvin.
Yeah. He is neither Marvin nor Taggart from Beverly Hills Cop. You can see both of those in him, yeah. But he's like this light, easygoing dude, and it's really funny to see him talking about these characters.
Right, right.
But yeah, it's was nice to see this little behind the scenes of this movie that I just really, really love.
Mm-hmm.
And Nick, I know you watched a new movie.
I did, and this is something my wife randomly found on Netflix. It is called Hush.
It's Batman?
Yes, but no. This is actually a psychological thriller/horror film, as we like to find just random horror movies to watch late at night. Who knows why? But no, this is directed by, I'm blanking on his name, is, Mike Flanagan, who directed Oculus, if you were...
which I thought was a solid horror outing, if not great.
Yeah. And this doesn't have really anybody in it that I was, like, amazed. I mean, I didn't know them. Like, Katie Siegel plays the main character. The only one I knew off the top was John Gallagher Jr. from Newsroom, who played...
Katie Siegel?
Not Katie Seagal.
It's not Katie Seagal.
That's right. This
is Katie Siegel.
Who's Katie Siegel?
She was in Oculus... But she's just an up-and-comer.
Okay.
But basically, this is the story revolves around sort of a woman, a writer, who's moved away from the city to a small home in the woods.
Okay.
She's also deaf, hence the title Hush. She's got a couple of friends in the home that's down like a mile away.
Uh-huh.
And a person runs afoul of her, basically a hunter/... You know, psychopath.
Yeah.
So this does sort of feed into sort of home invasion in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. but not in the way that I feel like some home invasion.
I'm guessing films, that many times in this movie you get her perspective and they mute the sound.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it actually wraps up the tension really well. There's. Yeah.
I hear that this new movie that's out, the one about the blind guy who's like a serial killer and they're locked in his apartment.
Don't breathe.
I hear it's like crazy intense.
Yeah, and this has definitely got some elements. The way the director and sort of thought about when he was filming certain scenes. Mm-hmm. Is just insane because you really are put into her perspective and
right.
kind of how do you account for your entire surroundings when you can't hear them?
Right.
So
you use radar sense like Daredevil.
Exactly.
When I was horror podcast I really liked, Knife Point.
Yeah.
They did a story about a couple of escaped convicts, and it was told from the perspective of one of them, and he's deaf.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, what the story was about was they're making sort of a long run through a forest, and it's a sort of moment-by-moment kind of like oversee of it from his perspective. And basically, they start noticing weird things around them. It's like they are not being targeted, but it's like they have wandered into some strange supernatural events.
Hmm.
And the way it was written from the perspective of a deaf guy really heightened it.
Yeah.
You know, I hate to think of it as like a novelty, but I will say it was a very intense story and something I'd never seen before. So I'm curious to see how this see it translated to a movie where it's going to be, I think, a more visceral sort of suspense.
Right. Well, I'm always worried about home invasion films sort of reveling in kind
right,
of
you don't
the
want
violence
to get to torture porn
and the torture porn. And this never does that. I've seen it since looking at some reviews that it compares it to sort of Hitchcockian kind of
yeah.
suspense and thriller. And I definitely think there's some of that in there. But I was very, very pleased.
That sounds
with
much more interesting
outcome.
Than Oculus.
Yeah, I think it is, and I think if he continues on this way, because I think this is his newest one.
The next one will be The Sense of Smell.
Yes. No. I honestly think this guy's got a really long career in the horror genre, so...
I would like to see the next James Wan, perhaps.
Perhaps.
I'm just saying, Oculus's eyes, Hush's hearing... His next Actually, movie next has to is, be Smell.
The next one is Taste, Randy.
Taste,
I was also happy to see, in a very
Hang
small...
Hang on, I've got to lick the killer. It's him.
Michael Trucco, wasn't he from Battlestar Galactica?
Yes. I know the name, I can't picture him.
Yeah, he played a small part in this, and I liked him in Battlestar Galactica, and it was nice to sort of see him show back up.
Who was he in Galactica?
He was one of the Starbucks like love interest towards the... latter seasons.
Not the dude who was the ball player.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
what
it was. Yeah, it was the ball player.
Okay, yeah. That was like first season.
Was that the first season?
He was introduced in the first season and I think became a love interest.
Yeah.
Either by the end of the first season or beginning of the second.
It's been a while since I'd seen Battlestar Galactica. Yep. So. Alright. What else we got?
Alright. Dave, I know that you have just finished up the much beloved and not at all controversial Gotham.
Yep. Well, you know, the interesting thing was, like, I suspect a lot of people, I watched the first few episodes, I was not into it. It was so tonally weird that I just could not wrap my head around it. I had no idea what they thought they were doing. But I kept on seeing, among other things, I mean, I knew some people who just liked the show. But I also saw a lot of reviews that were, this show is so bonkers, it's amazing. Like, you know, they were essentially hyping it up just on the basis of the craziness of it.
I mean, do you basically have to throw out all preconceived notions of Batman mythology when you watch this show?
Probably, although I would sort of say that for... You know, I'd say that for a DC thing. Maybe not Flash and stuff like that, I guess. But they are often reinterpreting their heroes.
I was going to say, because this really just reinterprets everything, right?
Sure.
I mean, every relationship.
And you know, honestly, I hate to say it, but there's like... This is not what I would call it tonally similar to, but it's like Smallville. You know, a lot of Superman villains showed up on Smallville years before they would actually meet him, years before he would become Superman. And they built their own mythology, so they were connected with... stuff that had happened within their own sort of storylines. Yeah. So as I was thinking about... So anyway, I ended up kind of plugging into Gotham. I was enjoying it. It's kind of ridiculousness. It does actually have some cool stuff. Like, I like sort of SAS Alfred. That guy is actually a good actor. Donald Logue is consistently cool as the... he's kind of a corrupt cop with a streak of honor as Harvey Bullock, the partner for Gordon.
He's got a weird relationship with Fish Mooney, doesn't he?
Essentially,
are they like ex-lovers?
Yes.
Or, okay.
Yeah. It's, that implication
so weird.
Just sticks
hey,
at the top.
Don Lowe can probably get anybody.
Well, it's interesting because, yeah, it's, you know, that sort of builds on it. It's on things. So there's a point in it where Fish is presumed dead and probably not, but... She's presumed dead, and he's essentially holds the Penguin responsible, so he's going to be particularly pissed at him because however bad a crime lord type person she might have been, he had a thing for her. I think kind of felt she had a sort of... She was a bad person with honor or whatever. But totally the show... two things I thought of that it reminded me of. One was a little bit of Darkman. That
yeah.
kind of manic...
Yeah.
The way the criminals were very larger than life in Darkman.
Yeah.
And sometimes... crazy things would happen, like you'd be in a warehouse and a deal would go bad and cars would drive out of crates. and that dude in was it Darkman took off his wooden leg and it had a machine gun in it.
Sure.
That kind of thing could also happen on Gotham.
Yeah.
And the other thing it reminded me of is the weirdness of Tim Burton's Batman.
Yeah.
Where, you know, like, sometimes, like, you know, the cops almost seem, like, sort of bumbling.
Yeah.
And then at other times it would be, like, sort of a dark crime thing, like when Jack Nicholson, like, electrocuted that one dude and then talks to his corpse for, like, 5 minutes for a soliloquy.
Yep.
Very Gotham-y, honestly.
Are you saying the Circus of Crime could show up at any moment?
Oh, the Circus of Crime would totally fit into Gotham.
Yes, yes.
You know, what's interesting, Dave, you mentioned... there's a news story that just came out recently. Bruno Heller, who was the showrunner in Gotham from, I think, just season one.
Yeah.
I think he's off it now.
Oh, is he?
Yes.
Okay.
But
yeah, I saw the story.
He was the one who came out and said, superheroes don't work on TV. I think it's the costumes.
Yeah.
Which is like, no, dude, you made Gotham. You don't have room to talk about superheroes on TV.
Well, he didn't do costumes. So you know, within his perspective, that makes sense. But yes, it's at the time when Arrow and Flash and Supergirl are all notable successes.
Yeah.
I imagine he's one of the, I don't think he's probably a superhero guy.
Well, that's the thing. I think that's part of why a lot of us got turned off by Gotham, is that it was being run by a guy who was maybe a little embarrassed about the source material and was trying to do something like elevating and art, making it arty. And I think what happened is they turned to the skid and realized, wait a minute, elevating this makes it silly.
Right.
So we need to either embrace the silliness, yeah, or just be made fun of for it.
That was sort of my problem with it, because I watched the first 4 or 5 episodes, and it was just all over the map. Right. I mean, not from one minute to the next, it was doing so much, and the tone would just shift completely.
Well, I mean, wouldn't you agree that that's kind of what Burton's Batman is?
Sure. It's kind of an entertaining mess, though, right? It's not like this is great TV. It's just entertaining mess.
Right. You have to kind of, find yourself. I found myself enjoying all of the characters in it, so anytime they would cut to, like CSI Tech Edward Nygma, a.k.a.
fun character.
Future Riddler, who's kind of an awkward dude, who his ongoing subplot in the first season is just asking a girl out. He's too awkward to do it, and we see him moving towards his criminal-type origins because she keeps picking abusive boyfriends.
Well, isn't one of her boyfriends Flass?
Yes, who... Honestly, I still kind of enjoy seeing the bits and pieces of the DC universe.
Yeah.
So Flash, of course, for people who don't know, is the corrupt detective, the really, really bad guy in Batman Year One.
He's actually more of an utter douchebag in this than he was in Year One.
Yeah,
a douche.
In Year One, he was, I think, more... he felt more threatening to me.
Yeah, yeah.
In this, he is like an uber douche.
Yeah.
But Flash, Essen, who in Batman Year One would be the cop who had an affair with Gordon, is the police captain.
Yep.
Lots of other small roles throughout. And I know that they're like in the second season weaving in the Order of Saint Dumas.
Yep. And we know in season 3 that's coming up, they're bringing in the Court of Owls.
Yeah. So clearly they are not yet. Like, as if there was ever any question of them trying to adhere to continuity. Not even a chance. I mean, they threw that out when they had Catwoman witness the murder of the Waynes.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they've resolved this yet, but suggested that the Wayne murder was probably some sort of political, mob maneuvering to remove them.
Sort of what they did in Batman
Earth One?
Earth One, yeah.
Yeah, and it also harkens back to the original, I mean, in the 70s, they did a thing where Rupert Thorne?
Yeah.
It was something like... one of the criminal, and I don't remember if it was him, it was another crime lord, it was someone, it might have been Thorne, it might have been somebody else, but there was a crime lord who had basically arranged to have the Waynes killed, and that story has been mostly buried and rightly forgotten.
Yeah. Now, but it makes sense on this.
Sure.
Because one of the things I liked about it is that they've sort of made out that the Wayne Foundation is corrupt, and that they're... that was secretly, what's Bruce Wayne's dad name? Thomas Wayne was sort of fighting that quietly behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And that probably is what got him killed. And that losing them may be of what caused the city to sort of fall into darkness, the darkness that Batman will have to fix.
Right.
And that's kind of a neat little, as far as like within a self-contained storyline, it keeps Batman's story,
his parents directly tied into it. How involved is little child Bruce Wayne?
He's pretty involved. He is investigating the mystery of his parents. It's the meta plot for the whole first season, and I think leads into second season too.
I hope 15-year-old David Mazouz in season 6 like takes up the bat cowl as Teen Bat.
they might. I'm gonna guess it probably won't make it that far.
So is only the first season on Netflix, or is they putting anything
else? Just the first season.
Is there just the first season?
Only that's on Netflix,
okay.
Yeah.
Season 2 is on Hulu still, I guess.
Oh, okay.
It'll probably transfer over for too long.
But, it is weirdly dark at times. People get killed all the time on this show.
Yeah. Did that Fish Mooney thing? Yeah, that Fish Mooney thing happened because it was on.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was insane. Although that storyline ended up making me kind of like the character. Did you see how they got out of that, Randy?
No.
Ultimately?
No. I've spot watched an episode here or two while my daughter was watching.
Her escape from the island of the Dollmaker.
Sure.
That's a weird character to throw in there.
Yeah, that's what's weird.
Is that even a character?
Dollmaker was he's a Morrison character.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I don't know if he's anything like this version of him. He's like an evil crime doctor to the rich who keeps people to organ harvest. Was that?
That doesn't really sound like.
They probably just ran their own direction with it.
Probably. Yep.
But her escape was actually pretty entertaining, just as far as like what her overall plan was.
The weird thing for me about Gotham is it feels like a throwback. It feels like a throwback to the days when we were so, like we were talking about, it was so happy to have any kind of Batman that it doesn't matter. They're basically just taking names and repurposing them that has no resemblance to anything in the comics. Like, it is about as true to the comics as say, like, Batman 89 or that kind of thing. And I feel like that was why it got so much heat, is because people are like, we're accustomed now to kind of getting what we want.
Right.
And so to get something that is basically someone's personal vision of a really weirdly interpretable character like Batman is off-putting.
Well, I think when
The reason I don't find it off-putting is precisely because they've been doing it at least since doing that at least as far back as, well, I'm going to say Batman 66.
Yeah, no.
Which, you know, was even weird. It was a specific kind of camp that was not what they were doing in the Silver Age comics really at the time. That was like Batman in space and stuff like that, and it was outrageous, but it wasn't campy.
Yeah.
And then in, like, Batman 89, I think, which we're all a fan of to varying stripes.
Yeah.
That was, for sure, like 60% or 70% Tim Burton.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of used to this happening with Batman.
Yeah.
And, like, so when I see something like Leslie Tompkins played by Morena Baccarin.
Yeah.
And she's, like...
And she's dating Gordon.
She's dating Gordon.
Yep.
She's still a doctor. She might be working on the Gotham PD, but, you know, it's within parameters. It's within acceptable parameters.
See, that's what I'm saying. You and I, and to some extent Nick, we grew up with this notion of we're not going to get superheroes the way we want them. Mm-hmm. And so we're much more accepting of very different change. That's why you plugged into Gotham. That's why I sort of plugged back into Gotham. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason it gets so much backlash is that a lot of people, especially younger people now, they're like, we had Avengers.
Right.
And we had Captain America and we had Iron Man. So the notion of this much compromise is just seems really weird.
I also thought it was just slightly strange because I felt like there was the blueprint for the Gotham Police with Gotham Central. And
well, it seems clear that that was never
what they wanted to do.
Right.
They took from that is a few cop names, and those are cop names that had been around in the main series before.
Yeah,
you know, here's the thing: I'm kind of glad that they didn't do that because I love Gotham Central, or liked many parts of it, but it would have been kind of a police procedural with occasional supervillain stuff showing up, and that's kind of dry and dusty. And I kind of like, because Batman's or Gotham City is such a fun playground, sort of a sandbox to play around in. I kind of don't like it sometimes. Well, I mean, I can enjoy it when it's kind of the more serious thing, but that doesn't sound as appealing to me as the kind of anarchic thing it became.
I actually agree with you, because I think Gotham Central, the reason Gotham Central works as well as it does, it's a breath of fresh air. It's treating the cops in a way that comics don't treat them.
Uh-huh.
Whereas if you treat them as, if you do a cop procedural set in Gotham, that is run-of-the-mill for TV. And I think you're right, Dave. I think it would have been like a Law and Order, but with a couple costume villains, and it would have been not that memorable. And this at least is memorable. It may not be great. Some people may not think it's great, but it's definitely memorable.
I remember that guy running with an ATM over his head. Yes. Hopped up on, what are they
Venom?
Called?
Yeah,
it was like a proto.
Called it like Viper or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, actually in a weird way, I like, one of the things that sort of works for me with this conceptually is, I always hate stories that suggest that Batman creates his villains.
Yeah.
Like, that maybe maybe Gotham would have been this great place if he hadn't have brought all the villains in.
Yes.
Batman's villains have created him.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. Is like, all his villains are going to be 20 years older than him.
Yeah. Most of them at least are like, you know, he's like probably 12 now, and like, you know, Riddler's only like, you know, he looks like he's in his 20s.
Yeah.
So they're not like wildly.
They're
older.
Only 10 years.
If they
older.
Should introduce, say, Harley Quinn, that'd be weird.
Yeah.
Well, they have done Joker, right?
No, they've hinted at it.
They've hinted at it. The kid Jerome from the first season. I think they're running with it, but then I think they killed him off. But then I suspect they're going to bring him back.
Yeah.
I think I've actually heard that they're doing that in Joker fashion. What seemed to be dead was not so dead.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is not like some wholehearted recommendation. Basically, it's if this is the kind of thing you like, this might be the kind of show you'll like.
Yeah. Well, a while before Gotham, and the reason I was kind of excited for Gotham, was Donald Logue did my favorite show ever, Terriers.
Yep.
Which is a private...
Almost certainly a better showcase for his acting talent.
Yes,
than,
yes. Which is a private eye show. It was a season one and done on FX in 2010. It had just abysmal ratings. Like, not enough people watched it. It is on Netflix. You can watch the whole season. And I am such a fan that I am doing a podcast called Beach Cop Detectives, which is launched, the website and everything launched yesterday. You can go to beachcopdetectives.com. There'll be a link on the show notes, and you can get the quick, like, 1 minute preview episode where we talk about this, the show that's going to come up. But next week, September 8th, will be the premiere, and it's going to be one episode a week. We're going to run through all 13 episodes, and I'm doing interviews with a lot of the creators, Tim Minear, who you might also know from Firefly and Angel, and Thief Sutton, who you might also know from Cheers. A lot of writers who worked on this. I'm also hoping to talk to Donald Logue at some point. So this is my big project. I've been working on this for about 2 or 3 months. I'm going to be working on it for another couple as we put it all out, and I'm really proud of it. Hopefully people will go and listen. You can find all the info at beachcopdetectives.com.
Hey, Randy, where is Terriers? Where can people watch the show if they want to, like, watch it, check out the podcast?
It's on Netflix.
It's on Netflix, yes. Right.
All right. That about does it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more, and until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.